Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO FM in Portland. This is Norm Diamond, your host for today. Patricia Culbert is our producer engineer. With today's program, the Moles inaugurate something special, not on the radio, but on the Old Mole Facebook page. Each week, we'll post a new photo from 30 years of work by activist, photographer, extraordinaire, Betty Lee, documenting Portland's history of street protest and resistance. If you've been to a protest during the past 3 decades, you've encountered Betty in the thick of whatever's going on. Here's an opportunity to see what photography from an activist point of view looks like, and read Betty's reflections accompanying each photo. Patricia Culbert will interview Betty Lee on our August 9th show. Back to today, we look to outer space and Voodoo Donuts, finding hope in workers' co-ops, and finding hope in Venezuela. Bill Resnick will interview Bruce Gagnon at the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Our final frontier is being abused in ways that threaten all of us. Luisa Martinez returns from a trip to Venezuela with a report on the effects of the United States government sanctions against the people of that country and the socialist spirit she found there. Bill and I will pull out a golden oldie from the Mole archives, a conversation we had in 2014 about whether worker co-ops in the United States can be a step toward socialism. And Joe Clement talks with a DWU organizer, that's Donut Workers United, about the firings and the organizing at the Old Town Voodoo Donuts. As I hope you know, KBOO is an extraordinary resource for the community, providing thoughtful coverage of what's covered only superficially elsewhere or isn't covered at all. It's alternative media, of which you are now listening to one of the country's outstanding examples, that provides not only reliable news, but needed perspective. Listener support is crucial, accounting for something like 80% of the station's funding. If you're able, please become a member or send a donation. Go to kboo.fm/donate or send a check to KBOO at 20 East 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. We don't do much on the Old Mole about outer space, but perhaps we should. It's becoming a prime area of conflict in the arms race and a dumping ground of space junk pollution with as yet unknown consequences for life on our planet. Here's Bill Resnick with Bruce Gagnon of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space.
Hi, Bruce Gagnon. Welcome again to KBOO.
Great to be on your show again. Thank you.
Bruce Gagnon co-founded and now coordinates the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. It seeks to protect space from the predators and the militaries. We discuss that, for one, really important, that outer space is now an arena of military conflict, with the U.S. seeking to maintain domination, but the Chinese and maybe the Russians challenging them. We also discuss the many companies, when space travel cheapens a lot, who want to make money and mining and other uses, and then I'll create space junk and pollution like what's happening to our oceans, with potentially great but still unknown consequences for life on this planet. First, though, some theater is absurd but dangerous. In the last several weeks, we've seen two of the three competing boy billionaires rocket off into space to get a glimpse of the Earth before returning to this spoiled planet. Seems to me this was just basically attention-getting self-aggrandizement to portray themselves as visionaries and heroic pioneers, maybe also make some extra bucks out of adventure tourism. Most folks probably thought of this as wonderful, or others, an amusing stunt. You didn't think either. Why is that?
Well, I call them the three space stooges, and it's definitely a public relations campaign. You might have noticed that Jeff Bezos was wearing a cowboy hat, trying to recreate the mythology of the westward expansion here in the United States, when the native people were destroyed, their cultures destroyed, their populations destroyed, in order to go out and get the gold rush and the land rush in the West, And that's the same thing that's happening now. Because space technology has been developed where you can go out and begin to privatize space and make money off it through all the years of NASA. NASA developed the space technology program. It was paid for by you, the taxpayer, but now under the Obama administration, Obama signed a law essentially privatizing space operations, and so we now see the gold rush begin. But there are real problems with that, and we're going to be witnessing them in the near future. You know, on Bezos' Blue Origin spacecraft that he went up on, it was fueled with liquid hydrogen, which is a very high carbon-emitting fuel. And what this means is he's punching a hole, a bigger hole, in the ozone layer that protects us essentially from climate change. So now, because of all these launches that are going on by all these guys, they're going to be worsening an already growing problem. I know out in your part of the country, the heat has been enormous lately. And so all those that are cheering for these space cowboys, take another look. Think about it. For example, Elon Musk has gone to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, and got permission to launch tens of thousands of mini satellites into space that will increase 5G operations on the Earth. The Pentagon is very excited about it because they say with the speeds that they will get from 5G, they'll be able to do more global surveillance, more global targeting, and more global attacking with greater efficiency. So this means further militarization of space. But one of the implications of launching tens of thousands of rockets, you can imagine, is again punching a bigger hole in the ozone layer, exacerbating climate crisis. And so this is what we face today. We've got to be wiser, if you will, about what's going on in space, and who's doing what, and how they benefit, and how we do not benefit. This is the situation we're in today.
They're also talking about mining the moon. Elon Musk has a plan for detonating nuclear bombs over Mars to create a sufficient amount of heat to melt the frozen planet and release water and carbon dioxide, which he thinks would then create a climate very near to the U.S., I mean, harebrained ideas, and he's pushing it. I mean, he's promoting it. His T-shirts, Nuke Mars. You can read about that on the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. There's an expose of that.
We have our Space Alert newsletter on our website. Our last edition, the cover story, was Elon Musk and SpaceX have gone nuts, and it was all about this very thing you just mentioned. So you can go find our website at spaceforpeace.org. It's true. Elon Musk wants to terraform Mars. He wants to turn the dusty red planet into a green, lush planet like the Earth. Many of us say, well, heck, why do you want to spend all those zillions of dollars to try to do that, including exploding nuclear weapons, as you said, over Mars? Just imagine launching all those nuclear devices. Imagine putting all those nuclear devices together at the Department of Energy laboratories spread around the country that have a long record of deadly contamination of workers, community water systems, community air. I mean, why? Why do we want to do crazy things like this and just allow one guy that said, hey, I'm going to go do this, and give him permission to do it? I mean, it's insane. So we need to have a lot more robust level of intervention by the citizens of the world to protect us from these insane psychopaths who are rushing to colonize space and to control it, which would violate the Outer Space Treaty, the Moon Treaty, that say the heavens do not belong to any one person, any one corporation, any one country, that heavens are the province of all humankind, and nobody can claim ownership. But that law that I mentioned that Obama has signed says American corporations don't have to follow international law, United Nations law, which I think is going to create a lot of conflict.
One other thing that I think should be mentioned in the discussion of the dangers, it's also going to put a lot of soot in the atmosphere, above the atmosphere, I mean, in outer space. And the soot is another powerful global warming material. This is your old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Bruce Gagnon, who co-founded and now coordinates the Global Network You just discussed the boy billionaires leading the way to commercializing outer space, including mining and adventure tourism. And as a power source, of course, for space users, we didn't discuss that. They want to put nuclear reactors in space. It sounds dangerous, it is, and now is the time to stop it, when at least the expansion into space of U.S. capitalism is still in its infancy. In contrast, what is already happening in Earth is spending lots of money, no longer just beginning. Outer space has become an arena of military conflict, with the U.S. seeking to maintain domination, but the Chinese and the Russians are challenging them. Tell us about the U.S. military in space and now the challenges.
Well, first, let me address your point about nuclear power. The nuclear industry views space as a new market. For many, many years, they've been drooling at the thought of, as you said, putting nuclear-powered mining colonies on the moon and Mars and asteroids. They also want a nuclear-powered rocket in order to get to Mars in half the amount of time that it normally takes with conventional rocket technology. And also, the Pentagon is saying they want nuclear reactors in space to power space-based weapons. So again, I take you back to the Earth. I take you back to the Department of Energy laboratories sprinkled around the country that would be in charge of fabricating all of these space nuclear devices for the nuclear industry to launch. And now and then, rockets blow up and the nuclear debris could fall back to Earth. In fact, in 1997, when the Cassini NASA mission was launched to go to deep space, it carried 72 pounds of plutonium-238 on board. And in the environmental impact statement, NASA acknowledged that if there was a launch pad explosion and a release of that plutonium, the winds would carry it for a 60-mile radius. They'd have to go in and remove all the people. They'd have to go in and remove all the buildings, all the vegetation, all the animals. Can you imagine the squirrels, the snakes, the birds, the bugs, the bees? And then they would have to remove the top half inch of soil because everything would be radioactive for thousands of years. Now, where would they put all that? What would they? It's impossible to imagine this. These are the kind of experiments, essentially, that they're undertaking with our lives and our planet. So we can't let them do it. Then at the same time, the Pentagon is talking, as you earlier said, that they want to control and dominate space. They want to deny other countries from having access to space. The United States wants to be the master of space. But since 1981, Russia and China have been going to the United Nations every year, introducing a new treaty called PAROS, P-A-R-O-S, Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space. Ban all weapons in space. The Russians and Chinese have said, let's close the door to the barn before the horse gets out. But the United States and Israel have been blocking the development of such a treaty to ban weapons in space this entire time through Republican and Democrat administrations. And I remind you, during the Trump administration, when the Space Force was created, a new branch of the military, it was passed in the House, which was then controlled and is still controlled by the Democrats. So the Democrats could have defeated Trump's proposal to build the Space Force, but they didn't. They supported it. The only thing the Democrats actually asked for in that negotiation, in that debate, was to call it the Space Corps, like the Marine Corps, rather than the Space Force. That's it. So we see that both parties support this militarization and nuclearization of space because both parties in Washington have long ago been taken over by the corporate money that flows from the aerospace industry. The plans are so big for everything space, as they like to call it. A few years ago, in one of the industry publications called Space News, they had an editorial, and they said, you know, we, the industry, the aerospace industry, have to be responsible corporate citizens, and we must come up with a dedicated funding source to pay for all of this very expensive everything space. And they say, we have. We call it the entitlement programs. We're going after them. We're sending our lobbyists to Washington to defund the entitlement programs to pay for this. And what are the entitlement programs officially? Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and what's left of the social safety net, which is in tatters today. So these are the programs that the aerospace industry has identified for defunding.
Well, they have their priorities, don't they? Talk about the Chinese and the Russians. Domination of space means that the U.S. has the power to kill anybody on Earth at the flick of a switch, surveillance. It also has the power then to destroy whatever it might be in China or Russia that the U.S. decides will weaken them sufficiently to just maintain their power. Well, China in particular is not ready to, in fact, become a secondary to the U.S. in terms of all sorts of global issues. And they are developing a capacity in space now, or they're developing capacity to destroy satellites in space and destroy these U.S. assets. The U.S. is responding not by saying we just have to stay out of space, but by trying to do many things to stop the Chinese from developing the capacity to constrain them. It seems to me this is an arms race in space. It's just enormously dangerous.
Well, as I said, for the last 40 years, Russia and China have been going to the United Nations advocating a treaty to ban all weapons in space. U.S. refuses. Israel helps U.S. block that treaty at the United Nations. But all this isn't new. After the end of World War II, the United States brought 1,500 former Nazi operatives, scientists, militarists to the United States in a program called Operation Paperclip. As part of those 1,500 people were Wernher von Braun, the Nazi rocket scientist that built the V-1 and V-2 rockets for Hitler. They came, he and 100 of his engineers and rocket scientists came to Huntsville, Alabama, to the Army's Redstone Arsenal to create the U.S. space program. At that time, this Nazis began testifying before Congress saying that we need to have orbiting battle stations in space that will allow us to control the pathway on and off the planet Earth so that we will be the master of space. We'll decide who gets out there in order to mine the sky. So this is like a Nazi prophecy come home to roost here today. It's coming into fruition, and we should really begin to understand where this idea of master of space comes from. It reminds me very much of Hitler's slogan, Deutschland über alles, Germany overall. What's the difference between that and master of space?
This is your old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Bruce Gagnon, who co-founded and now coordinates the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. Bruce Gagnon, you mentioned that China and Russia have been trying to stop the arms race in space with a UN treaty, which the U.S. and Israel oppose. That seems to me one way of trying to deal with this power, but the elites of the U.S. are not going to stop unless there's real popular opposition here. What's your sense of the way that opposition can be built? And also, I have a hypothesis that climate action forces who constitute a huge reservoir of opposition to the economic and growth patterns of the United States now and the rule by capitalist elites, even if they do not consider themselves an opponent of capitalism, they see the trends now creating a destroyed planet if they continue. Every climate disaster increases the opposition, and there's climate disasters to come that make the current ones look fairly small as the globe heats up. What's your sense of whether climate forces and others can recognize the dangers of going into space? Some of them, just like the soot and destruction of the ozone layer that you talked about, some of them, in fact, contributing a great deal or potentially contributing a great deal if the space madness continues to global warming. Tell us about that possibility of building forces.
Well, unfortunately, at this time, climate change organizations have been slow to recognize the military's massive carbon footprint. The Pentagon has the largest institutional carbon footprint of any institution on the planet. So when it comes to making that connection and seeing how the military and now these space launches impact climate change. Climate change groups have been slow to come around. We need to pressure them to begin to address this deadly connection. Secondly, the media control, the corporate media control over these issues is really dramatic. We're not able to really reach the public through corporate media, so we have to go around them with alternative media. On our website, again, spaceforpeace.org, we have lots of space videos. We put out a new video every month. And so I urge people to get on our email list, go to our website and look at these space videos and share them with others. Be proactive. Help educate other people because we need an immediate global debate and change in consciousness about the way we view the heavens. You earlier in the show mentioned crowded orbits from all these thousands of 5G launches by Elon Musk and others. Astronomers are very upset about it because they're ruining the night sky with all these blinking satellites, but also because of growing congestion in orbit now. Many scientists believe there's going to be a cascading crescendo of accidents up there that is going to knock out lots of satellites, which means that virtually everything we do on this planet is going to go dark because everything is hooked up, whether it's cell phone, internet banking, cable TV, weather prediction. I mean, you name it, everything is hooked up to satellites these days. So we've really got to look out for the future generations now by taking control of this whole space program in its many different manifestations. If we don't, I'm afraid there won't be much of a future left for our children and grandchildren.
Bruce Gagnon, thanks so much for talking to us. You're doing a lot to get that movement going. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
So long.
Thank you, Bill and Bruce Gagnon. Roaming in some ways even further than outer space, both in miles and in concepts, Luisa Martinez traveled to Venezuela. She was there as part of a delegation, but made sure to have some time on her own to experience the ups and downs of a society trying to build socialism, but under tremendous pressure. Here are some of her reflections.
This is Luisa Martinez taking the opportunity to give some political reflections on my recent trip to Venezuela. I was there for 20 days, and for four of those, I had the pleasure of attending El Congreso Bicentenario de los Pueblos del Mundo, which means the Bicentennial Congress of the People of the World, as a delegate for the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA. El Congreso was a meeting of socialist parties and leftist movements from 120 different countries, and it was timed in accordance with the commemoration of the Battle of Carabobo, which was the decisive military victory against the Spanish Empire. This represented both a historical and ideological theme for the Congreso. The Battle of Carabobo is today, we kept hearing, reflecting a continuing fight to realize the dream of Simón Bolívar, which is the struggle for independence. In the days of Bolívar, it was Spain, but it was clear that the delegates from every country understood the struggle today was for socialist sovereignty against the United States and against capitalist hegemony. Now, there's much ado in the United States about Venezuela from the right and to a small degree from the left. The criticism from the right is we can dismiss since it's mostly lies, but criticism from the left is something that we should evaluate within our movement. Now, one reflection is that prior to doing so, the top consideration must be the impact of illegal sanctions by the United States. Now, if I'm being frank, as a leftist, me personally, illegal sanctions are probably the least interesting aspect of the Venezuelan socialist project. But understanding the material and psychological impact of illegal sanctions, what are sometimes formally referred to as unilateral coercive measures, should be the first step in anyone's analysis of its successes or rollbacks. This is something I gained a new understanding of in my conversations with everyday Venezuelans, and I'm speaking as somebody who has been engaged in anti-sanctions work for years. According to a report by the human rights group SURES, the Venezuelan government has lost 99% of its revenues as a direct result of U.S.-backed illegal sanctions. 99%! So if we engage in the exercise of putting ourselves in the shoes of Venezuelans, we can imagine the immense hurdle that they've been presented with when it comes to whether or not gains can be made under the circumstances. As a Venezuelan, would or could your focus be moving forward or simply holding on to the gains that have been made, prior to the impacts of U.S. terrorism? From the Venezuelans I spoke to, the answer was unclear. Now, I feel obligated to state this is certainly not an excuse to give a blank check to Venezuela or any state in transition away from capitalism. Internal debates are central to any living, breathing socialist project. But it should give us pause for thought when it comes to the role we can play in the United States. Another reflection was understanding the influence of violence. I spoke to a woman whose father was a very popular Chavista. We discussed the varying levels of political consciousness within the country, and we also discussed how that serves as some explanation for how internal problems have been handled within the socialist coalition that's currently elected. One story she told me was when she was kidnapped as a teen as a result of her father's activism. After those 3 hours were over, she immediately called her father and said, and I'm paraphrasing here for the radio, "Look, I don't know what the hell is going on. Don't tell me, but you need to figure it out." And his response to her as a father was, "Okay, take my car keys and go disappear for a week." Now, not everyone supportive of the transition has parents who have the awareness to explain what's been going on in the country since the revolution. And she said her mother and her father took great pains to do so. So she understood the situation and what happened to her, but also said not everyone within the project responds the same way. Even if betraying the revolution is something she would never do, she has the clarity of mind to be able to humanize the opposition, to understand why a kidnapped daughter of a Chavista might waver in her support. Another thing, I'll add, she said rather casually, was, you know, if the right were ever to take control, right, they would kill me, they'd kill my family, whatever. That's an aside. The long-term impact would mean there wouldn't be another revolution in Venezuela for 200 years. And that's what scared her. Another political reflection was understanding the impact of the Guarimbas and the blackouts between 2016 and 2019. Guarimbas were violent protests by the Venezuelan right. People died and a black man was set on fire and killed in Caracas because his skin color alone signaled to the opposition he was their enemy. Which is to say, if he was black, he must have been a Chavista. One person I spoke to was an embassy employee who moved back to Venezuela around the time the Venezuelan embassy in the United States was handed over to U.S. puppet Juan Guaido. Food scarcity in and of itself is one thing that they were dealing with, but the blackouts, he says, are really what scared him. Venezuela went through a series of U.S.-backed blackouts, which were aimed at destabilizing the government. The United States did the same thing in Chile right before the coup that killed Allende. He was explaining it was dark. When you don't have power, you don't have any water because Caracas is a city that's elevated and water has to be pumped up by electricity. On top of that, there were the sanctions, so it was very difficult to get dollars. And it was when you don't have access to dollars, you don't have access to food. And so they were going 6 days, he said, without food, electricity, and water, and there wasn't any money to be found. And he thought, it's only going to be 2 or 3 more days, and people are going to start rioting, not even against the government, but just simply out of desperation, out of necessity. But they didn't. And the reason why is because people understood, after 20 years of revolutionary education, that this is an economic war driven by imperialism. And because of the revolution, there was a robust culture of mutual aid and helping one another out so they were able to get through that crisis. This brings me to my last point, which is hope. Now, I want to make it clear, I don't mean to harp on illegal sanctions as a way of portraying Venezuela purely as victims. When we, as socialists, make the commitment to socialism, we understand that this means we are at war with capitalism and that this commitment comes with sacrifices, including the reality of violence in every form. Venezuelans understand that more than socialists in this country could. And the biggest testament that I can convey about the successes of the Venezuelan Socialist Project was that despite U.S. terrorism, despite the pervasive threat of bloodshed from the far right, there is still a strong sense of hope. This was made salient to me personally when I came back to the United States less than 2 weeks ago. I was, to be frank, really depressed because the United States seemed, in comparison, overwhelmingly bland and colorless. I spoke about my emotional hangover of sorts to a Venezuelan friend, and they responded with this. Revolutionaries are sensitive to any social situation, and for you as a person involved in defense of workers' rights even more. I've never been to the United States, but I have a pretty good picture when I check the numbers. For that reason, I think you are still a little overwhelmed by the experience of your visit. Because in spite of our problems, there is a spirit of self-improvement in a large part of the population. What the subjective challenge will be in the case of U.S. society, I don't know. Possibly at this moment, that is the question that crosses your mind.
That was Luisa Martinez. I think Luisa has made the right choice for a U.S. audience in focusing on the effects of U.S.-imposed sanctions on the Venezuelan people. In reporting the dedication and hope she found there toward creating a socialist future, I think she's also brought us a gift. I want to add just a few words of caution or concern. One of the ways the Venezuelan government has coped with the sanctions and blockade has been to turn parts of the economy back over to private and even foreign capital. That decision has generated more food and other necessities in the short term, keeping people's spirits up. But as with similar responses to external capitalist pressure in the early days of the Russian Revolution, and more recently in Cuba, that decision comes at potentially a terrible cost to socialist aspirations, which, after all, is one of the purposes of the sanctions, isn't it? To prevent the establishment of a society with quite different ways of going about things, ways of much greater equity and humanity. I'm reminded of something Fidel Castro said. This was at a conference of foreign economists held in Havana in the early 2000s. A Cuban economist was addressing the gathering when Fidel came in and took a seat among the crowd. The economist was giving a glowing report about how Cuba had weathered the so-called special period in the 1990s when they were cut off from traditional trading partners. Fidel interrupted and said, "These are sympathetic internationalists. You should tell the truth." The Cuban speaker started quoting statistics about increased production, etc. And again, Fidel interrupted, "Tell them the truth." Finally, the speaker talked about how they had relied on private enterprise and capitalist motivations to overcome the sanctions. For the last time, Fidel spoke, "That's right, and it meant 1,000 cuts to the socialist project," he said. Venezuela's situation is fraught, a mix of exciting developments and decisions with uncertain outcomes. Luisa will return to the Old Mole in a few weeks with a report on another part of her experience, the Venezuela producer communes she visited, and on their extension into a promising new structure, municipal communes. Moving from Venezuelan communes to worker co-ops in the U.S., we return to an Old Mole roundtable we did in 2014. Bill Resnick and I discussed the political significance, or not, of creating producer co-ops here at home. After the Trump years, there's not much conversation anymore about building alternative workplaces. We think there should be. Here's Bill and I, a piece from our archives.
Hello, folks. I'm Mole Bill Resnick with Mole Norm Diamond. We're going to discuss a hot item now for progressives, cooperative production and cooperative workshops. We have many co-ops here in Portland, for example, City Bikes that sells and repairs bikes and bicycles, and People's Grocery Store. In both, the workers democratically manage the business. And at the national level, several large cooperatives with multiple businesses grouped together in inner-city neighborhoods, one in Jackson, Mississippi, the other in Cleveland, Ohio. They've been heavily promoted in the progressive press as a crucial focus for progressives, for radical organizing. Norm, the promise of cooperatives to free working people from wage slavery, the tyranny of bosses, and to free them to have comfortable lives, producing for one another. That's been a repeated theme on the left. There's been a lot of experimentation. Let's talk about what was learned.
Bill, it's been an intermittent theme. It's not been a continuous theme on the left. And right now, we're getting a strong upsurge in interest in worker co-ops, I think for various reasons, but one of them clearly is the failure of dominant institutions. People are generating co-ops partly as a survival mechanism. That's true in Jackson, Mississippi. It's true in Cleveland. People project those co-ops as if they're alternative institutions, as if they have promise not only as a model for a future society, one that empowers workers, one that's environmentally responsible, one that even provides fulfilling work, although I think that probably doesn't correspond to the real experience in Cleveland. We'll get to that, and to Jackson. But also people project them as if they were transition institutions out of capitalism to something different. And there, too, we're going to raise a challenge to that kind of prospect. As survival mechanisms, they have a long history. There's a hidden history within the African-American community of forming co-ops. As well, going way back to the 19th century, Knights of Labor generated more than 200 producer co-ops where the workers ran their own little enterprises specifically to not have to be responsive to market forces. But there's the rub. Unless they're very little niche enterprises, of course, they're subject to market forces, and that can destroy them or undercut the promise also.
You know, most, in fact, are relatively small businesses. Workers don't have the capital. Banks won't loan the capital. Every now and then you get a foundation that will set one up with several $1 million, as in fact in Cleveland. But still, even in Cleveland, the two co-ops that have been set up and one in planning are going to be small businesses competing in the market for these services that they provide. And the only way to compete in that market is either to do it so much better, which they can't do in their services, or to keep wages low. In Cleveland, my understanding is the wages start at $8.50 an hour, and then they go up to $10.50.
Yeah, and these are very far from worker-controlled enterprises. The problem they regularly encounter is other corporations won't buy their products or won't supply them.
Or they can't get financing.
Yeah, or they operate based on a kind of self-exploitation on the part of the workforce. We have a rich history here, we should acknowledge, actually, in this area in the Northwest.
In the plywood co-ops, yes.
Yeah. And I used to take tours of people through the Linton plywood co-ops and, of course, end up meeting with their members. There was a while when they flourished, but they ran into yet a different set of problems operating in a capitalist economy. Yeah, workers owned shares, and the shares became so valuable they couldn't be sold, for one thing. And another thing was when you're flourishing, you're hiring new workers. And they never figured out a way to bring in new workers into the cooperative mechanism. So they ended up with a dual workforce. You know, one, the owners, who weren't making any more money necessarily than other workers, but whose shares were making them rich.
Most of the plywood companies were bought by Weyerhaeuser and bigger ones because they were so efficient and so successful, but bought for huge amounts of money. And the co-opers made a killing and had very, very, very comfortable retirement. But the new workers they brought in who couldn't buy a share, they could have bought a share. Their salaries weren't so enormous.
New hires were exploited, same as they would be in any other kind of enterprise, because there were market pressures. This was not a mechanism to somehow escape the forces of the market.
No. Well, it did escape the highly hierarchical nature of capitalist firms. I went to visit Linton, too, and I went to one of their meetings just as an observer. And they really were democratic. 80% of the share owners and workers were there making decisions. Managers could make a decision for a $5,000 maximum. After that, the workers voted on it and discussed it. They were in charge of their plant, managing a productive operation. And I think that's something for those men. It not only was a comfortable retirement, it was a life of participating with others. And they were very tight with one another. And they also rotated jobs so they just didn't get into repetitive injuries. It was a better place to work.
Good. You're raising criteria that I think let us evaluate these enterprises, how much they change the labor process, for instance. You haven't mentioned that, and I didn't see that much in Linton Plywoods. The work itself was still structured in many ways the same way
as in other
They had an assembly line.
Yeah.
You can't do craft plywood one sheet at a time, gluing with your paintbrush.
Well, then you're raising yet another question, which is really interesting in evaluating any kind of co-ops, and that's who decides what gets produced, what technologies come in, all those kinds of questions. And then we're talking about more than the workers themselves. We're talking about, as well, ties with community. So already we're raising large questions that need to be addressed to think of these at all as transition kinds of institutions.
Well, let me though say something. You can be the devil's advocate, and I'm with the angels, Norm.
This is the usual arrangement in the old mole. Everyone should know this. Yes, go ahead.
Support those angels with gifts to KBOO Radio and keep this station alive. As Seymour Melman looked at various industries around the world, including plywood, and he compared the productivity, just the sheer productivity of a cooperative enterprise with a standard capitalist hierarchical one. And what he found was that they were far more productive, actually, which is why Weyerhaeuser bought Linton and bought others. The left has always said, look, and I say it all the time, what it demonstrates when a co-op is really working well, it demonstrates that ordinary folks doing a variety of industrial jobs, they make intelligent decisions and maintain the plant and do it better and hire and manage their managers. And it demonstrates that when you operate together democratically, it works better and it's good for people and it's more, quote, efficient or productive. And that includes the service and caring industries as well. And now, Norm, you can reply to that celebration of the cooperative ideal.
Ideal is right. No, there's no question at all that the cooperative movements we've had historically, 19th century up till now, in some ways model possibilities, show workers, in fact, can run the economy. There's no question. There's that capability demonstrated in practice. The question is, building co-ops, is it a transition to something better, to a different way of organizing a society? And there, I think, is where the real questions come in. And I am skeptical. What it really comes down to is how you go about building those co-ops and how you function within them, how you generate allies, what kinds of alliances, what kind of changed understanding happens within them, people's sense of capability and sense of activism, especially their sense of where the problems are in the society, why they're even building alternative kinds of institutions.
Let's get to that. I'm going to do a station ID, and then we will discuss the criteria that you were setting for evaluating these co-op efforts. I think we can be a little more critical in some ways of co-ops when they present themselves as the road to a better society rather than as a interesting sort of reform that has many useful purposes, but not the major focus of strategy. This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here with Norm Diamond of the Old Mole. Both of us do Old Mole work. Norm, not as often as me, but we always appreciate his presence. And sometimes the host shows. And we'd love to have you do it this summer, Norm. Are you committed to doing it sometimes in August?
You realize calling me a devil is not quite the way to promote my participation.
The devil's advocate is just being, that's what lawyers are. They advocate for anybody. On this show, for this purpose, you're the devil's advocate. You aren't a devil. And I'm on the side of the angels.
Yeah, lawyer was a career path that I rejected.
For good reason. From one who knew once upon a time. Norm, let's deal with each of those criteria you set up.
Yeah, the worker co-ops that we've seen are very much survival institutions. They do model possibilities. They have that merit. And they are enabling people to get by in an economy that can't provide jobs. The question, again, is whether in projecting them as means in and of themselves, I'll make a blanket statement. There's no institutional arrangement. There's no structure of an enterprise that per se gets you out of capitalism. Capitalism, the kind of economic system we have, is very flexible. There's all kinds of room for dissent within it. There are all kinds of niches for different possibilities. I've lived in communities where anybody could set up alternative little institutions and serve the local community. It doesn't end up challenging the overall kind of economic structure we have, nor the dominance of the large corporations.
Well, that may be true, but I think the response to that is if you look at it in terms of a development path of the current system, it seems to me that the more people who have experienced some kind of democratic workplace will, when, in fact, the system is forced into another one of its great rending reconstructions of the last several hundred years, it's going to have to change its whole industrial structure and the way it operates in response to this ecological devastation. When people are forced to choose, and it's going to require huge amounts of state resources and investment, when that happens and when people are have to choose to change their former way of life, it seems to me that if you had enough people who had experience in democratic workplaces and in democratic practices, not just workplaces, they may choose a path that's different than the path that the corporations and the admittedly fascist forces are going to choose. And it seems to me we have to promote those sort of democratic ideas, and co-ops are one way of promoting them.
I hear a very speculative, highly optimistic sense of worker co-ops. One is that, in fact, the existing ones are democratic or more democratic. I think you made a convincing case about some of the plywood operations, all of which have failed, and that those indeed had more democratic structures. If you look at what's happening in Cleveland now, in Evergreen, again, you pointed out minimum wage workers, and they have to hire managers. And, you know, the managers make the decisions, supposedly on behalf of the workers, or taking the workers' interests into account. When the steel mills were going to be restructured into worker ownership, the entire plan gave workers presumably 6 out of 15 members on the board of directors that would make the ultimate decisions. But it all was going to operate within legal parameters. They couldn't even talk to the workers they were representing. These are not democratic structures. It's not democratic experience. 2, and I want to come back to that point, what all this comes down to is how to actually work within these contexts, how to work with these reforms. But let me make the second point then about the optimistic statement, people who think of this as a strategy for change. It really is reliant on the state. It's not just that worker co-ops are being established now, but there's legislation. You know, Vermont has its own actually twofold kind of impulse. One is to create employee ownership training centers, and the other is a bank that will lend money specifically to worker co-ops, dependent on the state. No other state has gone in for that, but of course the Vermont senators have introduced that in the U.S. Senate. We'll have to see. We'll have to see what kind of a role the state, the U.S. government, and that structurally the state can play in this transition. I am not as optimistic because that state, at least right now, of course, is not responsive to those kinds of forces. These forces aren't going to work without funding sources, without the kind of technical training, without the kind of purchasing power represented by the state. But let's go back a step, though. The real issue, I think, comes to, as it does with any of our political enterprises, how do we actually work with reforms? When this is happening, what's our role trying to push further than just creating these survival institutions? We have to treat this as if we are indeed political organizers. We join the effort, but we try to push it further. We try to make these enterprises, for one thing, responsible to the community that surrounds them, too. We try to create those alliances, and we try to generate an understanding on the part of the workers involved that, look, you're showing how capable you are. We push that further, but we're also, what's the source of problems in this society? What needs to be changed? How does this new recognition of our own capabilities, how can that lead to something further? With whom can we join?
Yeah, and ask co-ops and insist that any co-op you're part of is part of a larger co-op system that shares those values and promotes them and uses some, if the co-op is succeeding sufficiently, uses a major part of its surplus or profits to, in that fact, enable other people to opt to begin enterprises rather than being dependent on financing from either foundations or government or banks. It seems to me you would want to see them confederating, the co-ops, confederating away behind those radical principles.
What are the radical principles they're confederating around? I mean, you're still talking in structural terms, and I'm having a little bit difficulty seeing it, actually. I think this is a question of our political practice, the left's political practice. Like any other reform bill, the radical principles have to be one. What I look for is, I said before, a reorganization of the labor process for one thing. So it's not people doing the same kinds of jobs that indeed have been structured with a built-in sort of hierarchy.
I agree. That should be one of the principles. That
has to be an involvement of the community.
I agree.
Another thing. And the community has to be part of deciding what the work outcomes are, what's being produced, and the allocation of profit.
Absolutely.
And the third, and I think major, has to be building a kind of consciousness. It's not enough to have a little bit different practice. People have to realize that the practice is different and have to understand it in that larger kind of context. We're not just making whatever little widgets we're making or producing lettuce like in Cleveland, the Evergreen Co-op, but we're building something toward taking down the larger economic structure, because it's what causes the problems. It's what doesn't provide employment. It's what's behind the vast inequalities in the society, et cetera. How the problems are understood by the workers themselves is key to the possibilities here.
Yes, and we will have co-op newspapers and radio stations and democratically run like this one, sort of, to help, in fact, develop that set of ideas, because these co-ops are not going to stand alone. They're going to be part of this larger cultural, political, productive structure. On the other hand, there's actually much more to say that we're going to have to say at another time. Co-ops cannot be the focus of building the other better possible world and necessary world that we need. Really, the focus has to be on mass movements of people who have no chance nor will be ever in cooperative production, even if they know about it. And our movements can, however, be democratic. Anyway, that's my last word. You can have your own last word, Norm.
No, I think that's a good way to conclude. It's those larger social movements where people also have the experience of participating in major kind of decisions, not just production kinds of decisions, but
right.
Policy decisions about the movement, about the society.
Thank you, Norm. This is Bill Resnick and Norm Diamond for the Old Mole, Old Mole Roundtable.
And for the angels and devils, apparently.
You're still.
I got called a devil, yes.
You did not. You're called the devil's advocate.
Okay.
You were just playing a role in a dialogue. Thank you very much, Norm, and don't be so sensitive. It'll undermine your political organizing efforts.
That was Bill Resnick and I, Norm Diamond, back in 2014. For our final piece, you've noticed tourists wandering around Portland, when there were tourists, clutching little pink bags of voodoo donuts. Have you ever wondered what working conditions were like for the people who make and sell the donuts? Joe Clement will fill us in.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm joined today by Samantha Bryce, employee of Voodoo Donuts and an organizer with Donut Workers United. Thanks for coming on the show today, Samantha.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So about a month ago, during the heat wave that killed hundreds of people across the Pacific Northwest and dozens in the Portland metro area, workers at Voodoo Donuts walked out of an extremely hot, dangerous work environment, and several of them have since been fired. And this Thursday, there's going to be a picket protesting those illegal firings at the Old Town Voodoo Donuts, which is on Southwest 3rd, just off of Burnside. It's going to be at 6 p.m. Samantha, could you tell us a bit about what happened that weekend?
Absolutely. So a little bit of the background on the heat inside the shop is that this is a yearly issue that occurs with Voodoo Donut. Particularly the Old Town locations, air conditioning is not strong enough to cool off the place, the entire restaurant, whether that be at the front of house where people are working with customers, or in the back house where people are frying. So this year, since we are organized into a union, we took it upon ourselves to address those situations, not only due to just general heat during the summer, but particularly with that 115 degree heat wave. And so the staff kind of took our own measurements and recordings of the heat. Leading up to the heat wave, we were getting regular days of 96 degrees inside at various locations inside the shop, and decided that if we were already feeling unsafe, not well in various ways due to the heat, that 115 degrees was not morally or responsibly the right choice to choose to keep workers working there, especially because the company offered nothing in the way of creating a safer work environment for us during that time. I believe the company kind of threw out there that they offered us water and rags, which I don't know about anyone listening today, but at a restaurant, that's kind of always on hand. So there was little to nothing done to alleviate the situation for us. So the staff took it upon ourselves to organize. We decided that it was best to offer the employer an option, either, you know, increase the safety conditions for those of us at work or shut down the restaurant for everyone's best interests. You know, we have a lot of people that work at our shop with a lot of different health histories and backgrounds, and we don't want to see any of our coworkers have an accident that could not only injure them physically by falling or by burning themselves, but we don't want to see someone come out of working those couple of days with heat stroke that will have lasting effects on the individuals. So we decided to walk out. We organized a strike, and 11 workers went on strike that day. We marched out of the building with our heads held high, and sadly, regardless of the discussion that we had with management, they took it upon themselves to fire 6 of those workers and intimidate another 3 into quitting. So because of that, we are now going to be hosting an upcoming picket in support of these employees who went on strike for the best of intentions regarding themselves and their coworkers. We just want more respect on the job. We want better safety conditions, and we want our management to care about our well-being at work. We're not robots. We have rights, and we deserve respect and care. On July 29th at 6 p.m. Southwest 3rd in front of Voodoo Donut, we will be hosting a picket to bring up these issues to the public, to bring up these issues to management at Voodoo Donut as well, and kind of show them that we are a union. We're not going anywhere. And we will fight tooth and nail to ensure the safety of not only our coworkers, but our customers alike. Because we are here for our community, and our community is here for us. And that's what we are going to be showing at this picket.
Could you say a bit about how folks can find more information about Donut Workers United and how to support them?
You can find us on either our Facebook, our Instagram, or our Twitter pages. Just search DWU or Donut Workers United, spelled D-O-U-G-H, Donut. You can keep up with what we're doing and where we're at through those pages. If you want to support us, I mean, by all means, please come to the picket. Bring a friend, bring your family, bring as many people as you can and march with us in solidarity. But also, we do have a GoFundMe. And if you felt like helping us out financially, supporting the workers who have been fired or any upcoming actions that we have, that is the best way to directly support us. Show up in person or help with financially with any way that you can. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Samantha Bryce, organizer with Donut Workers United.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Please come to the picket this Thursday at 6 p.m. in front of the Old Town Voodoo Donuts on Southwest 3rd, just off of Burnside. And tune in next week when I host the show and have Samantha back on to report about the picket and have a bit more of an in-depth conversation about the union campaign at Voodoo Donuts. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement.
Thanks, Joe. The Old Mole Variety Hour is a group effort. In addition to Joe, thanks also to Bill Resnick and his guest, Bruce Gagnon, to Luisa Martinez for part one of her report on Venezuela, and to Patricia Kohlberg and John Nelson for their producing and editing help. And a special thanks to the KBOO staff who've kept the station going under these strange and demanding circumstances. This is Norm Diamond. Tune in next Monday morning. Meanwhile, stay safe, stay active.